I see so many people spend precious time and resources on things that actually don't really move the needle for them financially. That time, those resources would be better spent on other things. A lot of this is perpetuated by social media. Some of these topics are super overrated. So today we are going to dive into some of the most overrated financial planning topics and tell you what's important, what you should be paying attention to, and what you can pretty much ignore. Welcome back to the Becoming Work Optional podcast. I'm Rachel Camp, and with my co-host, Matt Garasik, we discuss hitting the point where you no longer need to work, which we call work optional status. But we don't stop there because we believe most people don't want to retire and hang out on a beach drinking cocktails for 50 years. What we see is more and more people who don't feel that traditional retirement advice applies to them. They want to keep working once they hit work optional status. The difference is they want to chase projects that excite them, schedule their days in a way that makes sense to them instead of blindly following the 9 to 5 hours, and work from a mindset of impact instead of money. All right, Matt, we are diving into overrated financial planning topics. We noticed that we go on a lot of rants about this before we start recording. So we thought it'd be a good idea to share some of these with you, just because a lot of these topics we see people spend a lot of time on. And it actually ends up harming them financially because they're over-obsessed on one thing when they should be focused on some of the other things. And there's a lot of new financial planning strategies and investments in the zeitgeist right now that we thought we should touch on and just talk through if we actually think the juice is worth the squeeze on them.
Yeah, I think a lot of these, like, we'll see people come to us and say, you know, I want to do this, this, and this. And we look at their situation and we're kind of like, well, actually, you should probably spend more time worrying about this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think that's a difficult part of our job is kind of guiding people to see the stuff that is actually important versus the stuff that is marketed and shoved down their throat as important. Because ultimately, you know, that's what you're going to be paying attention to, the stuff that's like put in front of your face every day. So I think that this, what we wanted to do is really shine a light on, you know, what might just be a lot of really successful marketing versus mm-hmm. what is actually going to be impactful for you.
Yeah. And this idea started because Matt and I were ranting about direct indexing. It's seen a lot of attention in recent years. And I think this is, and we'll talk about, because there are some use cases for this for a certain subset of people. But I think this is a result of the move to passive investing. So a lot of these investment management fees have been lost because people are opening their eyes to more passive investing versus active investing. You've got a lot of people shifting out of active mutual funds, going to those index funds instead, saving them a lot in fees. But then there is some fees that are now lost because of this shift. So like I said, direct indexing has some use cases. We'll get into it. But my thought on direct indexing is that it's kind of another marketing ploy to get some of those management fee dollars back while under the guise of, well, we're passive investing.
Yeah. And I think that we're in complete agreement on kind of like the marketing around that to get back, get the dollars back into management and under, you know, a fee structure, because there are ways to structure like really efficient diversified portfolios with ETFs that are extremely low cost that there's a study, I think Morningstar does a study every year on fees, and it just continues to, like, the fees continue to go down, which is great for investors. Mm-hmm. But then that's where you're going to see things crop up like direct indexing or other things where it's like, well, this is what the wealthy are like. This has been something that's only been reserved for the wealthy. But mm-hmm. thanks to all these technological advancements, like, now the average retail investor can get it. And so my thing with direct indexing.
Should we explain direct indexing first?
Yeah.
I was just thinking, we haven't actually explained it.
Yeah, I guess we should. So think of it as, okay, you buy an S&P 500 ETF. You know, it holds the 500 or so stocks that represent that index. So to direct index, what you're doing is you're buying the proportion of that company. You're buying the actual individual stocks to comprise the index. So for example, if the S&P 500 is made up of 5% Apple, 5% Microsoft, 5% Nvidia, you're going to have 5% of your overall portfolio is going to be in each of those in the individual stock. And then you're going to hold all the other ones in their proportions as well. So the idea is that you're going to continue to track the index, but the benefits that are marketed are the tax loss harvesting opportunities, because you're able to, instead of with an ETF, that value of the ETF moves with the value of every single stock that comprises it, versus in the direct index, you might have 250 stocks go up and 250 stocks go down, and you actually have the ability to sell those 250 that went down to harvest the capital, the losses on those. There's value in that in some aspects, a few use cases, which we'll touch on, but Rachel, did I miss anything from the explanation there?
No, I think that makes sense. I'll explain kind of the way that it was actually explained to me early in my career. I remember the first time I heard about this, because I worked at a big firm. We managed investments for the ultra wealthy. So this was one of those options, was this kind of direct indexing. And then the benefit is the return after tax. So the idea is that we have some type of tax alpha that's involved with direct indexing that you don't get with index funds. And that's the ability to sell those stocks at a loss, harvest them. And the way that it was explained is, just assume you own Pepsi stock, okay? And Pepsi had a bad year in 2024. They are at a loss. Well, we want to capture that loss, so we want to sell the stock, but we don't want to be completely out of the market. We don't want it to sit there in cash. And you can't sell Pepsi, capture loss, and buy Pepsi again. There's a wash sale rule where that loss will be washed out if you do that. But what you could do is sell Pepsi, capture that loss, and buy a stock like Coca-Cola. So now, virtually, you have a very similar exposure, but now you have that loss, which you can use to offset gains. You can use to offset a very small portion of your income. And that's the idea behind tax loss harvesting. The issue with that is you don't own Pepsi anymore. You own Coca-Cola. So while they are similar, they are not identical. And as we're doing and making some of these shifts and starting to capture those losses, we have something called a tracking error. So we want to track the index. The index is a really powerful way of investing. Index investing is, we'll get more into that later too. But as you shift away and as you sell certain stocks, buy other stocks, you have something called tracking error, which just means that your performance compared to the index starts to shift away and it might start to look different. The argument with direct indexing is that we're replacing with really similar securities, so the tracking error should be low. But we've seen over studies that the tracking error, over a longer time period actually starts to increase. And now you have that risk of underperformance compared to the actual index. So that's one risk, is yes, we're capturing these losses, but we have the risk of tracking error, which means we have the risk of underperformance by using the strategy.
Yeah, I love the Coca-Cola and Pepsi analogy. I mean, that's like the perfect way to really represent, like, you're buying a stock with very similar exposure, but you're able to take that loss. But here, a few other things that I think are relevant is, as you mentioned, the tracking error. So, and the wash sale rule. So, if you wait, 30 plus days to get back into the original security that you sold at a loss, then you can avoid the wash sale rule. Well, what happens if the security that you swapped for appreciates over that time? And then now you have a short-term gain that you might have to recognize to get back into Pepsi, which is going to offset some of that loss that you were able to capture on Pepsi to start with, or you continue to hold the Coca-Cola position and the tracking error continues to grow. Because yes, just one simple switch from Pepsi to Coca-Cola isn't going to throw off your tracking error a ton. But as you continue to, you know, sell these companies and swap them out, there's only so many, you know, there's, you know, 500, I think it's not actually 500. I forget the exact number in the S&P 500, but
yeah, it's like 502 you know, or only, something.
Yeah. There's only so many that you can actually continue to swap, before, you know, you run into the issue of two things. Number one, you are actually going to get to a point where you don't have any positions that you can tax loss harvest anymore, because they are eventually going to grow to the point that even a massive correction in the market is not going to drop that value below your basis. So then now even you've kind of mitigated one of the huge benefits of direct indexing. So that is something there's studies that I think it's like after 3 or so years, like it really starts to, like the value of that tax loss harvesting really starts to go away. And then I mean, there's so much more, but I think just as like a natural segue from a tax loss harvesting standpoint, you know, tax loss harvesting is something we want to take advantage of when it's put right in front of us, when there's a market correction and we have a very simple, like, let's exchange this for this, capture this loss, and not really change our allocation much. But to seek it out as a means of, you know, generating better performance, I don't really think that you can make that argument, because ultimately down the road, you're going to end up selling that stock unless you do one of two things. You die and your heirs get a step up in basis, or you donate to charity. So other than that, you are eventually going to have to recognize a gain. And that makes the overall benefit of tax loss harvesting not tax avoidance, but tax deferral. So yes, there's value in that tax deferral, because the savings that you generate from not paying tax on the gain, it can be invested. So, you know, if you save $1,000 from tax loss harvesting and you invest that $1,000, you have that benefit over however many years. But there's other factors that kind of like mitigate that, depending on where your tax bracket is when you do the original tax loss harvest, and then you down the road recognize it. So a few different things there. What else did you want to touch on?
No, I think that's such a good point, is that this is not tax avoidance. This is tax deferral. And if you're doing this with an account where you are eventually going to need to draw income from it, then you have to understand that, yeah, you're not eliminating tax. You're just pushing it down the road. And maybe that's a good idea. It could be a good idea if you're going to pass this account on, because your beneficiary will actually receive a step up in basis, which will eliminate all of those gains. So it could be a strategy there. I think we see this strategy make sense for a small set of people. Before I get into that, let's touch on one more thing, and that's complexity. When you're doing direct indexing versus an index fund, you could hypothetically own one index fund and have exposure to the entire US stock market, the entire global market. It's extremely simple. And I'm a huge fan on simplicity when it comes to investing. I think there's a lot of value there in keeping things simple. On top of that, index fund investing has proven to be such a efficient and great way to invest, beating out almost every other method of investing when you look at the world of securities, that any deviance away from index fund investing, I am really skeptical of. So that deviance away in having that tracking error scares me. And then having to manage all of these different individual securities can be overwhelming as well. And as it stands today, this isn't a strategy that I don't think anyone is giving away for free. There is that added cost to it that we have to consider and say, is there outperformance? One, and is it worth it for this additional cost that I'm paying? And I see it in the range of 20 to 40 basis points. That's 0.2 to 0.4%. There are two things I'm very conscious of when it comes to investing, and that's simplicity and fee sensitivity. So those are two things that scare me, is instead of having a portfolio of a handful of funds or even one fund, now your portfolio looks like hundreds of individual stocks, and you have to have a certain amount of wealth even to properly diversify with direct indexing. So those are two points that scare me away from this strategy. Now, for the type of people that this might work for, is if you have a really large concentrated stock position, and from a risk management perspective, you want to get out of that and start to diversify out of that. So say you're an employee at a large tech company, you got a lot of stock at that company, got large embedded gains within that stock, and you're wanting to diversify outside of that. You're wanting to do it as quickly as possible, but you're not wanting to take a huge tax hit. Well, direct indexing could potentially work. It's impossible to say because we don't know how quickly we can generate those losses. Depends on the market, depends on the individual stocks. But that is a way where you can be generating losses over here and then selling out of that concentrated stock position over here and using those losses to offset the gain. That could be one strategy that's helpful. The other one I already mentioned, but where this doesn't count, maybe you're fine being really aggressive with tax loss harvesting because you know that you want to pass this account on to heirs and they're going to receive that step up in basis. But I'm thinking, you know, your high tax bracket, so you're going to really benefit from that tax loss harvesting. You're concentrated in just a handful of stocks. You have a large taxable account as well. And then the only other scenario I can really think of is if you, from a moral or an ethical or religious perspective, you really want to customize your portfolio. It's really hard to customize and eliminate companies if you are just investing in an index fund because you can't tell the Vanguard index fund, hey, I don't want to invest in this one company. But if you're direct indexing, most of the time, almost all the time, they do allow for that customization for you to say, I don't want to invest in companies in this industry, or I want you to exclude these types of companies. Doing that, you probably will underperform, but I do know people who are okay with that because they do want to eliminate certain industries or companies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you hit all the use cases. And I think the big thing that we always touch on is the fee side of things. You know, what really matters for you is your after-tax net of fee return. And when you're looking at, you know, whether it's, you're looking at an ETF that has like a 3.03% expense ratio versus getting a direct index S&P 500 portfolio, you're paying, you know, 20 to 40 basis points to have that managed and have like the ongoing tax loss harvesting. Number one, you know, is the tax loss harvesting, like the deferral of that tax bill, going to offset the extra fees paid? I feel like that's hard to really say yes to when you compound those over, you know, decades. So I think that alone is kind of something to be aware of. But like you mentioned, there's I think probably just like everything in personal finance, there are use cases for every single thing that apply to a specific subset of people. It's just a matter of not getting caught up in the marketing of like, hey, this was only available to the ultra wealthy and now it's available to everyone, so you should be doing it too. You know, you need to get an objective view of you know, where the incentives are to really figure out what's right for you.
Perfect. Yeah, I think that's a good overview of direct indexing. Spent a little bit more time there, but that's what inspired this episode. So we kind of have a lot of things to say about that. I say, let's dive into the second one I'm most excited about and maybe more afraid to dive into. Have we touched on dividend investing before in this podcast?
I think we do. Yeah, we do have an episode.
All right. Do we want to go into that one then? Or
Yeah, I mean, let's just high level, right, and then we can high level. We'll figure out where which episode that was so they can go back and listen to the whole thing.
So next topic, let's go into dividend investing. We do have an episode on this. We'll link it below if you want more detail, but we'll go very high level here. So the biggest shock to me with dividend investing is seeing so many young investors really interested in chasing dividends. Now, there's a lot of research out there. You can look into this, but briefly to explain kind of my approach when it comes to investing is, I don't really care where the return comes from. If it's dividends, great. If it's appreciation, great. All I care about is total return. And there's no indication that if I chase dividends, that is somehow different than appreciation or better. And I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes from, is people see dividend as this kind of guaranteed stream of income. And there's a confusion among a dividend yield and a safe withdrawal rate. So sometimes you'll hear people say, well, rather than a 4% withdrawal rate, I'm just going to chase a 7% dividend yield and live off of that. That is really, really, really dangerous advice, and ignores the mathematics behind return and a safe withdrawal rate completely. So dividend investing, the way that I approach it is I don't care about it. I don't care if it's in my portfolio to some extent because there is tax impact of dividends. I just want the best return. And that doesn't mean that I need to chase dividends. It means I can hold companies that have significant appreciation and pay no dividends. Some of these companies that have had the highest growth in the past decade have no dividend policy or have only recently implemented a dividend policy, like Amazon, like Facebook, like Netflix. These big tech giants have had amazing returns without ever having that dividend policy implemented. And some of them are starting to implement that, but that's a very recent thing.
Yeah. And I think the biggest misconception that people get is that dividends are just like free money. So dividends are simply a distribution of profit. Like when a company has excess profit, they can choose whether they want to retain that in the business and use it for research and development, or, you know, paying employees, whatever it is, you know, paying, like bringing in more talent, whatever it is. So they can either distribute that out to you and then you get taxed on it, or they can reinvest it and grow the company. So if that dividend is instead reinvested in the company and that leads to a, you know, a growth in the share price of $1, that's the same as if you got a dividend paid out to you of $1, because it's just simply appreciation. So now if you needed income, you could just sell that, and you are actually in control of when you're taxed, and you can control, you know, whether it's short or long-term capital gain. And the other thing is, you know, we mentioned that dividend is a distribution of profit. When a company distributes a dividend, it reduces their share price because that is now no longer included in their value. So mm-hmm. it's whether it comes to you in the form of a dividend or appreciation, it's yours as an owner of the company. You're a shareholder in the company. So that represents, you know, your portion of the profit distribution. So there's just, like you mentioned, I think the really tough part is seeing how many young people are like obsessed with it, because I think it goes back to, and we have, I think we're going to touch on this a little bit later, but this obsession now with passive income, because everyone sees like Grant Cardone or any other like influencer, and they're like passive income. So then people look at dividend investing and say like, oh, it's passive income because I'm just getting these dividends distributed to me. But there's so many like underlying factors that you're overlooking. You know, we talked about the tracking error earlier. You know, when you exclusively invest in dividend paying companies, you are eliminating a large subset of the overall like investment universe. You know, you're probably eliminating small cap, mid cap companies, mm-hmm. A huge portion of them. And then, like you mentioned, a lot of the really big companies that have had exponential growth are the ones that are reinvesting their profits back into their company to grow more. You know, I don't think you would talk to anyone who would say, I would rather get these dividends than be invested in this company that has whatever, you know, 100% return or whatever mm-hmm. it ends up being. You know, like there's, you would rather have the total return, like the highest total return. So that's we dove into it more in the dividend episode, so we'll link that. But that is just a constant one that's top of mind, and that people seem to prioritize without really understanding how it translates to their portfolio.
Yeah. I think with this topic and with another topic, my frustration is giving investing a job that only you can do. So we see a lot of this and see a lot of it on social media. We see a lot of it among younger people, where they are chasing what they believe to be higher returns, outperforming the market. They're wanting to make a lot of money, which is great, but they're doing it through means where it's really difficult to make more money. So dividend investing is a great example of that. Now, I think we'd be remiss if we don't touch on crypto really quick here too, because I'll tell you my biggest frustration with crypto. I'm not really a crypto lover or hater. I would get maybe indifferent to it at this point, but my frustration with it, if there is any, is that it's kind of being marketed now as your way out, as anybody who is in a poor financial situation, you want to get out of it, like crypto is your way out and it's your only way out. I'm seeing that over and over again, and nothing angers me more, because crypto's not your way out. You're your only way out. You want to reach outperformance. You want to make a lot of money. Your best bet is yourself there. And so spending your time listening to podcasts on crypto or writing social media posts on crypto, to me, is such a tragic waste of time that you could be putting into something else that's creating skills that could benefit you for your entire life. We don't know what's going to happen with crypto, that the story's not over then. Yes, I'm aware that it has had tremendous performance, but there's obvious risk there. And I know, without getting too deeply into it, there is speculation there, because it's not a fully adopted asset class yet. It's not fully adopted currency yet. My favorite quote on crypto is by Jason Zweig, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, who says, "You can be right about the future, but wrong on how to profit from it." So we can be right about crypto, we can be right about blockchain, we can be right about where we're moving, but wrong about how to actually capitalize on that. There's a lot of people who go to Bitcoin thinking this is the sure thing. It's still a technology at the end of the day. Technology is constantly disrupted. So in my mind, it's not a sure thing. But the more tragic thing that I see is just so many people handing over their ability maybe to get out of a poor financial situation to something that is so out of their control. And so that's the rhetoric around crypto that has really frustrated me, and I definitely think is overrated, is that crypto is not going to save you. It's not going to be your way out. It's certainly not your only way out.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head as far as like the marketing of, like, you know, this is how you save, you know, your awful financial situation that you dug yourself into. Both of us are kind of like self-development junkies as well. So it's like, you know, we have the same belief of, like, the only person who's going to save you is you. So, like, don't put all your eggs in this basket of, like, hoping that, you know, the penny stock or the meme coin that you're putting everything into is going to bail you out of what you've done, like all the poor financial decisions you made before that, because I don't know where I got this from, but I definitely am stealing it. But it was like, if you gave everyone, like if you started everyone off with $1 million, there's a really good chance that the people who are rich now would be rich again, and the people who are poor now would be poor again, because a lot of it comes down to the decision making. You know, yes, there are plenty of circumstances where that might not be the case, but for the most part, I believe that that's the truth, and that's what would happen. And with crypto, my thing is, like, if you want to integrate it into your portfolio, by all means, you know, go ahead. But when you have people basically saying, "I'm going to put everything that I have into, you know, Dogecoin or whatever meme stock or coin there is, because that's what's going to be what bails me out," and, you know, like, you're missing the opportunity to level up your skills, to make more money, to put into the market. And, like, we have so much data and historical performance of just, like, investing in profitable companies in the US and abroad. And just there is a blueprint that shows you that over the long term, you can make money. So if you're able to understand that, like, it's not all going to come at once, and that you need to build on that, like, there is a blueprint for you to grow wealth. Like, mm-hmm. I think that is one of the most important investing concepts, is just understanding that, like, there's data there that, like, this is what you need to do, and, like, you will reap the rewards. The final thing that I want to mention too, and it's not so much crypto related, but a little bit, just because a lot of times the people who are putting a bunch of money into, you know, these penny stocks or meme coins are the ones that don't have a lot of money to invest. So that's why they want to buy these really cheap speculative investments, because that's what they can afford, you know, quote unquote afford to invest in. Well, when it comes to investing, when you're first starting out, you know, a 70% return on $10,000 is not going to change your life. It's not until you really get up to like $100,000 that you start to like see the benefits of the compounding. You know, like when you have 20,000 and like you have a 17% return, like there's, I see this a lot of times from people who start investing is like, they say like, all right, well, I have $20,000 invested and like everyone's saying that the market is on a tear this year, but like, I'm not seeing it in my portfolio. It's like, well, that return, like you're from a dollar return perspective, like it's not going to feel like you did great. And that's just like the circumstances that you're in, just because you don't have a huge base to compound right now. And that's why I think so many people get caught up in like putting it into penny stocks, because it's like, this is what I can afford. So if I get all of these shares and then there's 100% return, then I'm like a bazillionaire. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, I'm sure there's statistics out there on it somewhere, but I'm sure that it's probably around the same odds of like winning the lottery.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, if you're just starting out and trying to figure out, you know, what you should go in and believing that because you don't have as much, you should go high risk. I mean, just keep in mind, I would treat 10,000 the same I would treat 100, the same I would treat a million. Like that, while 17% return looks a lot better on a million than it does 10,000, 17% is 17%. And we want to avoid scenarios of going back to zero, because from zero, we can't build. So it's even if you don't have much to start off with, it doesn't mean I would say, yeah, well, at that point, be as risky as possible. If anything, I would say you'd have to be a little bit more careful. But really, I would say I would treat it the same no matter where you are. It would just still need to be based on you, your time horizon, purpose of the money, everything like that. And you want to build those solid behaviors anyway. So, you know, and with this, we're talking about crypto, but really this applies to any high risk investments, penny stocks, meme stocks, anything like that. It's all kind of the same philosophy for what we believe. All right, let's get into real estate and specifically the idea of this being passive income. Now, it's funny how this is labeled as passive income, because in the tax code, it actually, that's technically what it is, passive income, unless you're a real estate professional. But if you're somebody who's wanting to invest in real estate, you have a full-time job and you're kind of wanting to do this on the side for extra income, know this, that the label of passive income for that activity is strictly accurate for the tax code, and then it stops there. After that, it's a lot more work, and they, of course, it depends. Are you self-managing the property? Are you paying somebody to manage the property? But the thing that we see a lot of people get stuck with is they listen to a lot of podcasts or social media of all this passive income people are creating, these, what is it, mailbox checks or whatever they call it, where it just doesn't tell the full story. My husband actually has rental properties, and I see him constantly talking to tenants. When we go back to where these rental properties are, he's having to manage them, and I don't envy him at all. If anything, I've thought to myself, this is just more reason I don't have a desire to get into real estate anytime soon.
Yeah. This is like an anecdotal experience, and probably why I'm I don't really have any interest in it. But growing up, my parents had, I don't know, like 4, 5, 6 rental properties of some sort. And like in a nice area, like in the same like town that we lived in. It's not like they're like slumlords. And like people just don't treat the houses well at all. And like, this is not, it's not everyone. But like, it's just going back to like, there's work in it. Like I remember being in like third grade and like painting walls at like a rental house, or like carrying carpet out because we had to rip the carpet up and put new carpet in. It's just like there's very like, you have to, before you can make real estate or any kind of investment into passive income, there's a lot of work up front. You know, it's just this old saying of like, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it. If there was really free passive income in it, then I think everyone would be doing that instead of, you know, their day job. And, you know, you see the people that like amass these huge real estate portfolios, and then they are able like to say like, oh, well, I have this passive income stream. Well, like they've amassed such a large portfolio that now they can afford to pay a management company to basically like take all of it off of them. It's just it's called like the economies of scale. It applies to, you know, everything in business and in life, whatever it is. You know, once you get, you know, the momentum and like the size built up, then you can start to really benefit from these things. But, you know, when you have one or two properties, you know, paying a rental or a management company is going to take away like pretty much all the profit. And then we're not even going to get into the complexities of the tax benefits, because a lot of people get so fired up about like, oh, I'm not going to pay any taxes on my rental income. But they don't understand like real estate professional status, and how those are actually passive losses. And yeah, we're not going to get into it all today,
That's for
but
another episode.
yeah, just need to really drive home the point that like, yes, real estate can be a successful way to invest and build wealth, but it is anything but passive.
Yep. And that is an important point to hit on the tax. If you're doing this for tax efficiency, please look into it for some tax advantages. A lot of the tax benefits, in order to really use them, I mean, you have to be more active in the and then you're a real estate professional. So look into that. And then not even to touch on the leverage required to make a lot of this math work as well. But that's what gets people in a dangerous situation is over leveraging themselves. So you have to be really careful here to understand your debt to equity. Can you afford to take this on? And then finally, do you even want to do the work? So much of this is a discussion around how your resource of time and how precious it is. And when I think about it, and I was considering real estate investing, I thought, but my business over here is doing really well. And what if I just kept investing into that or into myself? What if I, rather than diversifying and trying to spread out and create multiple streams of income, what if I just went really big on one? And I can tell you that's something that has paid off for me. So rather than chasing like the next thing, the additional stream of income, think about just doubling down on what you're already doing. If it's something that you can create more income with, chances are it's going to be a better deal for you. So that's real estate investing. The other thing is private investments in your portfolio. Again, this comes down to we see people who like are wealthy and they think that they should have access to different types of investments because they've reached a certain status, or we see people who see the wealthy investing in this and are thinking, oh, that's how they built their wealth. I want a piece of that.
Yeah, and it's there are, you know, opportunities for huge gains in private markets. There's opportunities for huge gains in public markets. There's opportunities for huge gains in real estate, in crypto, whatever. There's always the potential in most things that you're going to invest in. But what we really need to focus on are like the most likely outcomes. You know, investing, the reason there's a high return potential for private investments is because typically those are going to be your like your early stage companies or you know still developing, where there's a higher risk. You know, there's maybe it's if it's like angel investing, you really just have no idea what the outcome could be, because you're investing in the very early stages of a business. It could end up going to zero, and I think that's something that I always try to really like put in the minds of clients when they're considering any kind of private investment. Is like, okay, if this goes to zero, let's just pretend it does. Like, is that what does that do to your overall financial plan? Like, what does it do to your ability to accomplish all the things that we've talked about that you said are important to you? If it puts that in jeopardy, then like, why bother? Because it's not, like I said, there's potential for gains, but it is not a requirement to have private investments to grow your wealth. I think a lot of the times, it's like a status thing. It's like you like people want to be able to be at the country club and talk about the this private investment that they're in that, you know, no one else can buy. Like no one else is has access to it at their like in their friend group. So gives them like this level of prestige. But ultimately, outside of just the risk, you know, there's going to be additional embedded fees in these investments as well. You know, I think a lot of times, especially people in the financial services industry, know the term like 2 and 20, because it's going to be like a 2% management fee and then 20% of the gain that you're giving up. So it's like the returns better be really, really high if that's what you're paying. And you know that's why you see some of these hedge funds that are able to generate such like hefty returns. They're able to then charge the fees that they charge, but those there's a reason that those are like very exclusive and hard to get into. And I think that that is another point is like the quote unquote private investments that you know maybe the average person of like a $5 million net worth or something that like you're doing really well. You have a lot of money and like you are probably in a really good position to do everything that you want. Just because someone pitches you something doesn't mean that that's really like that exclusive. There's a really good chance that that is just simply their job to pitch you these things because there's a commission in it for them. So that's just some stuff to look out for, I think, ultimately, and just understand that it's not a requirement to be able to grow wealth. It's not how every wealthy person accumulated their wealth.
No, I mean, unless you work for the hedge fund, there's a good chance no one's actually creating or building their wealth to that point from these private investments. Something that they start to look into once they have built the wealth and now they're looking to diversify or go into other things. So that's the common misconception is that's how the wealthy built their wealth. No, most of the time it's just how they diversified it. And then there's that famous Warren Buffett study, if you or bet, whatever you want to call it, that he had with the hedge fund manager of I bet my S&P 500 fund can beat your hedge fund over a certain time period. Spoiler, Buffett won the bet, but you can look into it because I also, the hedge funds responded with, well, it wasn't the right time period and there were other factors. So that was a funny one that I appreciated Buffett for doing. Let's run through some of these other ones just really quickly. And I'm going to give like high level thoughts on it. So traditional retirement, I think at this point, we all agree that it's overrated. There's a lot of studies that actually have come out that have shown that retirement can have very negative benefits on someone. And it's important to remember here when we're talking about retirement, most of the time, and we see these negative benefits, it's because somebody retires from a job and then they retire to nothing, essentially, or they don't have a plan for post-retirement. But there are things that you can do, like second careers or part-time work or volunteering or getting really into hobbies or something like that, that we can still say you're engaged. And I think that's the important thing is when I talk to younger people about traditional retirement, it's like a glazed over look in their eyes. They don't care about it. They've never thought about it. But when I talk to them about work optional or financial independence, that's when I see their eyes start to light up a little bit more. So I think that's a very important shift. It's kind of the premise of our podcast is canceling retirement and bringing in this alternative of financial freedom and just switching maybe what you do rather than going into a full retirement made up of vacations and watching TV all day.
Yeah, and I think and like the same like hand what goes hand in hand with that is like the extreme frugality to get there to get to this to get this stage of work optional or financial independence and just basically sacrificing everything that you have and being just probably just not fun to be around when people are like that to begin with but like just trying to spend the bare minimum and cut every single expense. Like ultimately, you're better off focusing on maximizing your income, and like learning the skills that are going to help you earn more income. And yeah, like the name of the podcast, Becoming Work Optional. We're looking at being able to, reach that point of your life that you can spend your time and your money on the things that you're interested and passionate about. That ultimately is so much more appealing, I think, than retirement. And I think I personally, like in client conversations, I try to shy away from even saying retirement because it's just like not really on the radar for a lot of the people that we're working with. So that's, I think we have to touch on that being that the name of the podcast. Couple smaller ones, and this is going to be, it might be taken as like a attack on Dave Ramsey,
I was just
the
going to
paying
say,
off,
sorry, Dave Ramsey.
the paying off your mortgage early, or paying off every single piece of debt before you start investing. There are ways that you can customize this to your personal preferences. If you don't like to carry debt, I mean, I personally, like, I don't want to carry any more debt than necessary. I like to have the freedom for cash flow to be able to like have the flexibility to make investments or act on opportunities. But at the same time, if I locked in a 3% mortgage, I'm not going to prioritize paying that off over investing in the market because, you know, if you have a 30-year mortgage or something, you know, that money invested is so much more valuable to you than paying off the mortgage. You know, it's just a simple arbitrage opportunity of looking at what you can earn versus what you're paying in interest. So that is, there's always like little nuances to these decisions, but the, you know, just think of like the interest rate that you're paying as like the hurdle rate of what you need to be able to earn in any kind of, you know, investment to make it more worthwhile.
Yeah, just please do the math on this before you decide, before you blindly follow some Ramsey advice. I've seen some egregious math on his end with like telling people to delay their employer match before they until they pay off their debt, and just other things. So, you know, everybody has their own psychological approach to debt. Some people hate it, some people, I won't say love it, but don't care as much. So that is important to factor in, but do it after you run the numbers, or maybe before you run the numbers, because it's important to see, okay, I hate my debt. I want to pay off this 3% mortgage, but what does that look like for my finances if I spend the next 10 years aggressively paying down my mortgage and don't invest a dollar? It's not going to look pretty. So know that you can continue to pay down debt and you can invest. It's not always one before the other. There are different types of debt. Some debt is better, some debt is awful, and you should prioritize it. It just needs to be taken case by case, and you need to run the numbers for yourself. So last one we'll touch on, but that is writing off business expenses. And that's obviously a great thing that you should do. You should take deductions for business expenses. The bad thing is you see write-offs as free money. This is another social media issue that we see a lot, especially on TikTok. I almost said RIP, but I think it's back already. So with these business expenses, what you're getting when you write them off is simply a tax deduction. So you're saving on the taxes with those dollars. It's not free. So buying that really expensive car through an LLC, there's a lot of problems with that. But one of them is that it's still not free money, that you are still paying for it. You're just simply saving on the taxes when it is a legitimate, key on legitimate, business expense, and you have a legitimate business, not just an LLC that you opened up.
Yeah, I'm not going to bother to even extrapolate on it anymore because, like you said, it's simply not free money. It's a deduction against whatever rate you're paying taxes at. But I don't know about you. I really enjoyed this because I think that we touched on a lot of stuff that a lot of people are probably seeing all the time. And you know, rather than just going really in depth on one topic, I think that hopefully this just spurs some thought for anyone who's seeing these things put in front of them and wondering if it's right for them.
Yeah, if you watch a 6-second video, maybe fact check it before we start jumping on using it as a strategy. But yeah, this was great. You know, all of this is very high level. If you want any more information on any of this, some of these we have episodes on that you can dive into, or write us, say, hey, I heard what you said about real estate. I'm confused about tax or whatever. Can you go more into that? Feel free to send us questions like that. We're happy to dive deeper into any of these and maybe dedicate an entire episode on it. But that's a wrap for today. So if you want to find more information on myself, Rachel Camp, website is rachelcampwealth.com. Twitter is camp_wealth and campwealth everywhere, other social media platform.
Yep, and you can find me at my business website, unrivaledwm.com, and any social media platform at Matthew_Garasik.
See you guys next time. Like the disclosures say in the bio of this podcast, this content is strictly for educational and informational purposes. And because everyone's situation is unique, you should consult with the appropriate professional before enacting any of the information you may hear in this podcast. You should not construe any such information or material as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. This content is provided as is. And although the material is believed to be accurate, no representations are made that the content is error-free.